You know, in my home state of Delaware is WVUD, 91.3
That's
FM.
Right.
It's on my radio. It's on our house.
The Vice President of the United States.
You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you on August 2nd, 2015 from my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, co-host Kelly and I discuss U.S. political mega-donors, the past, present, and future of Medicare at its 50th anniversary, and the link between U.S. banking reform and Nigerian anti-corruption efforts. All that is coming up right now on Arsenal for Democracy. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Sunday and is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. Welcome to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm in studio this week with my co-host Kelly. I'm Bill Humphrey. Kelly, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
We're going to start by talking about mega donors in the 2016 election. As usual, when we talk about the presidential election, we try to find sort of big picture angles here. And $1 million donors seems like a good big picture angle. These are people who are not donating to, well, maybe they are donating to the presidential candidates themselves, but for the most part, they're donating to these super PACs, which I think when that Citizens United decision happened, I think we all thought that like there wasn't going to be a lot of disclosure and that was going to be the big problem. Seems like a lot of these people don't care. They just wanted a way to do it, and they don't care if their name is associated with it. For a long time, people like the Koch brothers sort of operated in the shadows. Then they, you know, started donating publicly and took a lot of heat for it, but it probably also helped raise their brand profile for politicians. So at a certain point, I think they all decided, well, we have more money than God, so who cares if we're getting yelled at periodically? No one's going to do anything substantive about it. So the New York Times compiled a list of the, I believe, 30 people or companies that had donated more than $1 million to various candidates, and they broke down the sort of percentage that each person or entity had donated to the campaigns or associated super PACs. Obviously, some of the candidates are pretty much abusing the system to the maximum extent, like Jeb Bush openly fundraising for his super PAC and telling people to donate to that, and that they like that super PAC is run by people that are his, you know, close advisors from previous points in his career. These are people who know exactly what they should do and what the campaign is going to do, so they don't even need to coordinate once the race starts because they've already pre-coordinated everything, essentially. So I just wanted to like look into some of these things. I guess there were technically like more than 30, but there were 30 sort of tiers, I think, of donations made down to that $1 million level. The most amount of money that was donated was $11.3 million from Robert Mercer, the co-chief executive of Renaissance Technologies, a hedge fund management company, and that was 98% of that went to Ted Cruz or a super PAC associated with him. So Kelly, what were some things that you noticed or wanted to point out about this list?
So what stands out to me is that these super PACs are determining not only who wins these races, but who is entering these races. All of a sudden, we have to pay a lot of attention to someone like Ted Cruz. As you said, he's getting 98% of Robert Mercer's donations. And then at number two, the $10 million from Toby Neugebauer. It seems to me that you should not even consider entering a race unless you have a super PAC who is going to be spending hundreds of millions of dollars on your race. I heard even a story this week about whether or not Donald Trump's pockets are deep enough to fund his own campaign. And the truth is they might not be deep enough. Of his questionable $10 billion of wealth, that might not even be enough to run his campaign. So it's disheartening to see sort of the price of democracy written out right in front of us. and the fact that many good candidates might have been sort of squashed before it even started because they knew the super PACs weren't going to be on their side. They couldn't get hundreds of millions of dollars lined up.
Yeah, I think one of the things that happened in the 2012 election was there was a lot of speculation that you know, that the super PACs were going to play a huge role, but we hadn't actually seen yet how they could or would function in a presidential primary. And what we saw was like Rick Santorum and Newt Gingrich, to a lesser extent, being kept alive well after their campaigns had functionally run out of money. And just, you know, these super PACs just kept on churning away. In particular, Rick Santorum, I mean, he ended up winning states with virtually no campaign infrastructure at all because Foster Freeze just donated a ton of money to this one super PAC that was aligned with Rick Santorum. And then at least allegedly there was no coordination. I'm sure there actually was, but they were, you know, doing the robocalls, identifying people, you know, buying the vote lists and stuff to figure out who were potential voters for him, you know, hiring volunteers to do the various, you know, door knocking and phone campaigning and stuff like that. All these different things. You know, that wasn't even the advertising. I think that was the mistaken assumption going into the 2012 election, was that these super PACs were just going to be focused on, you know, making these giant ad purchases. And they're doing that to, you know, to some extent, but a lot of it seems to be just, you know, no, let's just have a really huge campaign operation that completely circumvents all of the FEC rules regarding the campaigns normally. And although they are disclosing in general, it seems, these donors, they're not necessarily under as much disclosure requirements as the main campaigns still are. They don't, I don't think they have to like release who all their staff hires are and things like that. So this seems to be like the new, like now that they've all seen how you could use them in 2012, this is now the big, you know, the big attempt to use them. And as you said, you've got candidates that maybe aren't even that popular with voters, but they have no reason not to run because they're not, you know, one of the big reasons that candidates drop out is because they run out of money and they don't want to go into debt, or they've already gone into too big of a debt. This removes sort of any of the risks and downsides of staying in the race, right? They can just go that distance. And I think you mentioned Ted Cruz in particular. I think he's a really good example of this, because for anyone who's been paying attention to Ted Cruz since he was elected in 2012 to the U.S. Senate from Texas, his personality is such that he doesn't get along with almost anyone. And that includes a lot of fellow Republican senators, not just the ones who are running for president, but many others. And he sort of, in his mind, he has this like moral framework for his worldview that is unquestionable, unchallengeable, undebatable. If you try to debate him, you know, he's the former debate captain guy who will debate you about it or whatever. And like, he probably thinks that he's winning. I'm sure that more of the time these days, especially now that he's not in college or whatever debating, I think that it's more just like people get annoyed and frustrated with him and they leave, which doesn't necessarily mean that he won. Speaking as a former debate captain myself, right? There's some people who don't know when to turn it off. And Ted Cruz seems to be one of those people. And I don't think there's going to be any real sign of somebody like him dropping out. Like, he could be consistently getting, you know, 3% in all of these primaries or whatever. And like, he's not going to drop out. I think there's a very good chance that, I don't think he's going to get the nomination. I don't think he's going to be running mate or anything. I think there's a good chance that he will refuse to endorse whoever does win, because he's that type of person who sees that as like a compromise. If it's not, you know, perfectly aligned, then that's an unacceptable, immoral compromise or whatever, because he sees these things in very black and white terms. And so, yeah, this is going to keep somebody like him alive. Another one that you had mentioned when we were going over this before we started recording was Rick Perry. I mean, sort of surprised there how much he's raising this time. I think it would have, if this had been the last cycle, I would not have called this a big surprise if we had seen these kind of numbers coming in for him. Rick Perry was one of these people who, as governor of Texas, which has very, very loose rules regarding campaign finance for state elections, he was someone who would openly be like, okay, write me a $500,000 check or whatever, and I'll make you the commissioner of such and such or whatever. You know, I'll put you on the head of this panel, that kind of thing. And so he was a very effective fundraiser at that. But he turned out to be a terrible fundraiser in federal terms when he ran for president last time, because he didn't know how to raise money when there were those strict limits. Now, a lot of those limits have actually been raised. We've talked about that before on the show as well, that the Supreme Court struck down a bunch of limits, or said that they could be much, much higher than they previously had been. But even so, clearly a lot of this money is going to his super PAC. But I mean, like, why are people supporting him this time?
It just strikes me that the campaigns have sort of become this very elite version of betting on horses, where you need at least a $3 million buy-in. And I'm just not sure that Rick Perry is a horse that I would bet on right now. Yet he has the number three funder, Kelsey Warren, has given him $6 million. And at number four, Darwin Deason has given him $5 million. So it's honestly baffling to me, where it's still unclear who will be in Thursday night's debate. But Rick Perry doesn't look like he's going to make it. And there's $11 million that have been donated to him, essentially, through super PACs. And they're not even going to get to see their guy on the main stage Thursday night. So, it is baffling to me that maybe I don't understand what it's like to have billions of dollars, whereas $6 million giveaway is no big deal. But it is baffling to me the way that these people are choosing to spend their money on candidates that really don't seem to have a viable run in front of them.
Yeah, and also not even a viable future. I mean, where does Rick Perry go from here in a way that benefits them? I don't see a political future for him. And he ran an incompetent campaign in 2012. I think most people famously remember him flaming out on the stage when he couldn't remember the three departments that he wanted to eliminate, which was his cornerstone of his campaign. But, you know, and then there were all these other things about questions about whether or not he was having trouble during speeches in New Hampshire because of back pain medication, things like that. I mean, where does he go from here? How is he going to help them?
I wonder if in some ways these donations are being used as sort of a branding mechanism for the donors personally, or for the companies. You mentioned the Koch brothers at the beginning, and the Koch brothers used to be famously secretive, and now they run commercials for Koch Industries. You know, they keep the lights on in case you didn't know. So I'm wondering how the image that these companies and individuals are trying to portray is affecting their donations as well. I don't know. Does it help the Koch brand to be seen as, you know, wild right-wing funders, or does it not help them? And clearly they're not afraid of it hurting them. And that's a question that has just popped up over the past few weeks. What are these individuals getting out of these donations if they're not expecting their candidates to win? Because they're smart people. So I'm assuming someone's given them the 411 on Rick Perry.
Right. And also, like you said, what are they getting out of it? Because I think the assumption has been in the past, and I've definitely been a proponent of this assumption, is that these activities are functionally rent-seeking, which is an economic term for where people or companies, invest a significant amount of money in trying to influence the government to save them an even larger amount of money than they're spending. So, if you can spend $1 million lobbying the government, or doing, you know, or buying a, you know, favorable candidates, things like that, and then get $2 million in tax breaks, that's a, you know, obviously a good investment for you. But as you said, what's the payoff here? That's what's coming through to me too, is that a lot of this, it seems like, well, maybe these people just, that's not even what it's about anymore. Maybe they're just, they genuinely are like, well, I have a huge amount of money that I can never possibly use on anything in my lifetime, so why not just write gigantic checks to candidates who may or may not succeed? You know, what's the harm? Because when it's a field of 17 people, I suppose, on the other hand, you don't know who's going to make it through. And maybe, you know, it's like high stakes gambling. Well, no, it's high monetary gambling for very low stakes, because there's very little blowback risk here. If you write, you know, $2 million check to somebody and they don't win, like, whatever, that's probably not going to hurt you that much. Yeah. I think also these are clearly much wealthier donors than we saw as the big people in 2012. I mean, somebody like Sheldon Adelson was, you know, certainly well-funded and everything, but like Foster Freese was a major player, as I mentioned before, with like the Santorum campaign in 2012, or the PAC associated there. Yet he is actually small potatoes by most of these, like compared to most of these people. I mean, he's not even on this list here, and maybe he hasn't written any checks like that yet. I wanted the, obviously we're talking a lot about the Republican candidates because there are far more of them and they're far more willing to accept this money. You know, we've got a very narrow Democratic field at this point, you know, possibly expanding to include Biden, you know, if all the rumors are true. You know, that's for another time, I guess, to talk about. But the only candidate who is a significant player in terms of big donations, either to her candidacy or her PAC, is obviously Hillary Clinton. And she does show up as a recipient on this list, but not a lot, especially compared to most of these guys. You know, and I guess to the extent that she is showing up, it's, you know, in a significant way, it's just because, again, because she's the only one, really. But her name appeared here, I think, about 15 times or so. You got the Hollywood liberal donor base or whatever, Jeffrey Katzenberg, $1 million from, you know, he's the CEO of DreamWorks, Sheryl Sabon, Herbert Sandler. So, you know, some of these people are entertainment industry people. Some of these people are financial industry. We talked about that last, 2 weeks ago. So not surprising there. Steven Spielberg, also a well-known name on that list there. And there's a few sort of advocacy groups, but I think interestingly, you constantly get this lumping together in media reports of big donors, individual donors, or corporate donors, and unions. And I don't this does appear on this list. I think maybe one of them appears on the list. The UA Political Education Committee, which is a advocacy PAC run by a plumber and a pipe fitters union, and they donated $1 million to Hillary Clinton. But like, again, that's $1 million relative to this huge list of contributions going to these Republican candidates from individuals or even companies, you know, the various private equity firms and things like that. And I don't think that labor unions are a huge force in the way that they're put into parity with these corporations and corporate type donors in the media reports. And there's a very simple reason for that. Not only is union membership in general declining, but all the money coming from these unions is coming from things like dues, which they also have to spend on other things, and is a very small finite amount of money, right? And they, you know, most of it's going to their various union related efforts, but it's coming in very small amounts from their members. And they don't have a lot of money to burn. They don't have infinite reservoirs of money to spend on these things, on any of the candidates, particularly not potentially losing candidates like this. So there's no way that you can reasonably compare the amount of money coming from labor unions these days to corporations.
For sure. And I mean, the idea of a labor union is a group of people signing on to a set of values, a set of ideas that would, you know, make their lives better, make the lives of their families better, and those people pooling some money so that they can even begin to contend with some of these bigger individual donors is a totally different conversation. And should be noted that they're not contending with those bigger individuals. $1 million is just way less money than $11 million, and that's $1 million coming out of the pockets of hardworking Americans who are standing up for their industry and their union. So totally different conversation. And I agree that they should not be lumped together like that.
Arsenal for Democracy is going to return with more U.S. news and political analysis in just a moment from arsenalfordemocracy.com and WVUD. We'll be right back. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Still with me in studio is Kelly. We're going to talk now about the 50th anniversary of Medicare, which just passed. That was signed in July 1965. Medicare, obviously, always a hot topic, but particularly a hot topic given the confluence of the 50th anniversary, the 2016 Republican presidential field still hating Medicare, and also the baby boomers starting to transition into in ever larger numbers into the Medicare system and potentially putting strains on an already strained system. So let's talk about Medicare. You know, what it did in the beginning, where it has come since then, what its future might be. What have you been reading about regarding the 50th anniversary so far?
So one thing that I find particularly interesting is the continuation of Medicare and Medicaid and how Obamacare, or the Affordable Care Act, plays into that. During his weekly sort of fireside chat, President Obama said that the Affordable Care Act has finished the job that Medicare and Medicaid started 50 years ago. I find that to be a little bit of a grand statement, especially since there's still so much we don't know about how, or especially since the Affordable Care Act is still relatively new, and there's a lot to be seen about how it plays out. I am of the belief that if Medicare and Medicaid has taught us anything, it's that the job is never finished when it comes to providing healthcare for our country's citizens. And as society changes, people live longer, technology develops, this is a conversation that's never going to quite end from where I see it.
Yeah, I had also heard some things along similar lines, and that bothered me as well. You know, I think a few years ago, let's say 2010 or whatever, when this law got signed into place, the Affordable Care Act, there were many progressives who accepted it and understood that it was a very hard-fought, hard-won battle and then needed to be defended. But I don't think that a lot of progressives thought, oh, well, mission accomplished, like we got everything done. I mean, for one thing, we've had all these Supreme Court battles that have dragged things out. The Medicaid expansion, you know, still has not taken effect in all these different states because so many of them opted out based on the Supreme Court decision allowing them to do that. So there's just so many people that are still without insurance despite this. And again, I'm not trying to downplay how difficult it was to get the Affordable Care Act through, and how important it is in its own right, right? I don't want to downplay that, but to call it like, you know, to portray it as the capstone or finishing the job, I think is at best naive and just pretty disingenuous beyond that. Again, I get why President Obama would try to refer to it that way. I mean, this is clearly going to be a centerpiece of his legacy. It's going to be a thing that is something that he is sort of defined by in public memory for decades to come. I mean, because of how they insisted on calling it Obamacare in opposition to him, this is going to be inextricably linked to his presidency. So I understand the like wanting to play that up and not downplay how like hard of an achievement that it was. But again, as Kelly said, it does not go far enough. It was a first step. If you want to put a good spin on it, you can say it's a first step, you know, in fixing a bunch of these remaining problems. But to suggest that it like, well, we finished everything is just factually incorrect because of how many people ended up not being covered. And Bernie Sanders, he has been saying, you know, I think as he's been saying since 2010 or whatever, again, he's been making that argument. This was an important step. It was a step in the right direction. He did vote for it. But that doesn't mean that like that's where we should stop and that we should just stall out. And I think Democrats in general have a tendency to get something done and then think, okay, now we don't have to do anything about it for 20 years. And then they only start working on it 20 years later. They don't even, and then it takes them another, you know, 5, 10, 15 years to actually get something through. So that, you know, I saw this criticism that really bothered me of someone saying, you know, oh, Bernie Sanders is downplaying the president's signature accomplishment, and that's a great way to win over Democrats or whatever. And it's like, okay, are you mad that he's acknowledging like a true statement, which is that it was important and is doing good things, but doesn't go nearly far enough? I mean, I don't like, I understand there's a balance to be struck here, but I don't think it helps anything to like blindly go around telling the American people that this is this amazing capstone that has solved all of our healthcare problems in this country. It clearly hasn't, and voters know that. Even the ones who aren't, you know, the unreasonable anti-Obama fanatical haters or whatever, there are still many people who acknowledge that it's not really it hasn't fixed things. You've still got private health insurance premiums going up by huge amounts every year. That's going to continue to be a problem. So just this, like, I don't think that it's wrong to say, yes, it's important and it's a key step, but we need to go further. And in Bernie Sanders' case, he's making this argument that it should be go much further and go in that Medicare for all direction. And I also want to mention while we're on it very briefly, I don't think that Bernie Sanders gets nearly enough credit. He sticks to his ideals and everything, but he's very pragmatic too. You know, there are some people who are sort of just protest politicians who never support anything. I mean, you know, you got that on the left, the often the Kucinich types, and then on the right, the Ron Paul types, and they'll just vote against everything. Whereas Bernie Sanders, again, he, you know, wanted a more ambitious bill, but he did vote for the final version. He wasn't going to, you know, kill it based on that. He also had inserted a provision that has proven very important, which was, I think, a relatively small amount, like $8 million or something, but it was for rural community health centers, the CHCs. And, you know, he did that because he's from a rural state, Vermont. But this is something that's going to be very important and continue to be a major issue, is the lack of funding and support for hospitals and healthcare providers in very rural areas, many of which are Republican, but not exclusively. And that is something that was, you know, he helped improve the bill that way, right? And then, like, so, and that was actually about health care rather than health insurance, because that was another criticism, was that the bill was really not a very ambitious step on health care. It was more about health insurance. I think part of the issue here is we're not, other than, you know, a few people like Bernie Sanders, we're not, as a nation and as Democrats, going ambitiously enough in the way that, like, Lyndon Johnson or somebody did on Medicare, right? I mean, that was a truly ambitious step forward, even if it was only for, you know, people 65 and older, and it was also very difficult to get passed. But I worry that Democrats are tinkering around the margins too often and not presenting these grand ideas. They're too afraid of it being, you know, dismissed as socialism. Once they endorse the Republican ideas, like Romney Care becoming Obamacare, then it just pushes the Republicans even further to the right. They end up saying, well, we can't accept that either. I mean, it's like the whole thing about how cap and trade was supposed to be an environmental policy compromise between doing nothing and carbon taxes. And it was the market-based solution or whatever. And then once they endorsed this, you know, cap and trade thing that was supported by George H.W. Bush for things like acid rain, then that becomes the extreme position that all Republicans have to fight against. So, I mean, there's political reasons and policy reasons that Democrats should be taking much bolder stances. And I don't think it should be understated how important and how big of a step forward Medicare actually was. I mean, you know, there's the obvious health implications for it, financial implications. A lot of people, you know, I think like a third or something of people over 65 were not able to get health insurance at the time. It was just too expensive, or they couldn't get a policy offered to them at all. That has obviously been hugely important. But there are all these other ancillary effects too. Medicare gets criticism for, you know, is there too much fraud potential? You know, is it not doing enough to control the spiraling costs? There's all sorts of controversies, very legitimate ones, about how different things are priced. But there were also things that, like, you don't hear about that much. I was reading this study from 2006, and they had a section on Medicare's efforts to reduce disparities. These are talking about, like, racial disparities in health outcomes, and that's a complex problem. But they specifically talked about how one thing that you don't really hear about is that in 1965, you had black hospitals and you had white hospitals, and everything was very segregated, especially in the South by law, but also in many other states that were not in the South. And you couldn't, if you were a black doctor, you couldn't even practice at a white hospital. There was even legislation on the books that would provide federal funds for the construction of racially separate hospitals. And then in 1966, as a condition for participation in Medicare, basically, if you wanted to get your hospital reimbursed for Medicare and get this huge pool of people over 65 to come to your hospital, you were required to desegregate. And the federal officials actually enforced that very stringently. And it said, and this study said, in a matter of 4 months, and they're quoting a paper by Smith in 1999, more than 1,000 hospitals integrated their medical staffs, waiting rooms, and hospital floors in just 4 months as a result of this legislation. Obviously, again, That did not fix everything magically overnight, but that was something that was very important for Medicare. And, you know, they could have easily passed a version of the law that didn't deal with that. But instead, they said, let's think ambitiously here. Let's think big picture. How can we really move this forward? And yeah, they had to fight really hard to get Medicare through. But that's what you do. I mean, that's the whole point of going into politics, right? You're not just there to be tinkering around with the status quo. You're trying to, especially on the Democratic side, you're trying to move things forward and really improve things for people. And I don't think that we're doing enough of that anymore, and that it's now become this situation where someone proposing something really ambitious is considered an extreme outlier or a leftist or whatever. And it's like, no, guys, like, that's what you're supposed to be doing. That's the whole point of this. Why are you even in politics anymore?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of my favorite Hillary Clinton stories was when she was establishing her campaign in 2008, and they were talking about what her positions were going to be, and she said, well, universal health care, that's how I feel about health care. And one of her staffers said, come on, that's like way far to the left. And Hillary Clinton said, it's universal health care or bust. You know, why are we running if we're not running to provide health care to more people? And I'm not a huge Hillary Clinton fan because I haven't seen more moments like that from her, that big picture thinking. And I agree, this Medicare and Medicaid, the fact that it's standing 50 years later, the fact that we're improving upon it with the Affordable Care Act, shows that if there is a good idea, even if it sounds a little leftist, you know, you can present it and work with the right to come up with, you know, a good change for the country. And I think that you're right. We cannot shy away from big ideas such as this one, because 50 years later, we have decades of data to support the fact that it improved the lives of Americans. It provided healthcare for people who needed it. And I think as a civilized nation, we owe that to our citizens.
This touches on something that I've talked about, I think, mostly off air with our contributor Greg periodically. But I worry that one of the reasons that Democrats don't pursue these big ideas isn't for the, you know, I don't want to call it conspiratorial angles or whatever, but, you know, there's this always the default suggestion is to blame everything on, you know, ties to the insurance industry or ties to Wall Street or whatever. Let's take that out of the picture for now. I think there's another possible factor here that's influencing a lot of these politicians, which is that many of them are baby boomers or people who, you know, they grew up in the 60s or they grew up after the 60s hearing about this. But especially on the Democratic side, I think a lot of them are influenced, especially on domestic policy, by how, you know, what were things like in 1965 and 1966, right? So you've got the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act and Medicare and Medicaid. Those are all in the can at that point. They're taken care of. And then sort of saying, okay, well, now we've accomplished everything, right? And that was sort of the last, like the final last few years of the height of American industrialization as well. This period following World War II, but before, you know, some of the financial drag associated with things like the Vietnam War, the oil shocks of the 1970s, inflation, it's that last little period there where the economy was an outlier essentially in the United States, doing really well and was not going to be sustainable. But they didn't necessarily realize that. But there's a lot of people, I think, in politics and even in the voting electorate who think 1966 was like that was the it year. That was when we finally fixed everything, and we should go back to that or not go forward from that. That we should just stay stuck in 1966 because everything was perfect. That now clearly it was not. You had a lot of huge unrest going on still. Racial unrest continuing, certainly, and the Vietnam War and all kinds of things were actually not going that well. But there's this nostalgia, I think, for 1966 and for, you know, some of the stuff that they remembered hazily as little kids in the 1950s. And there's this perception that this is the highest point in policymaking that was ever reached was 1965. We'll never surpass that. We can never improve upon that. And I think that's a mistaken thing to think for any number of reasons, but also, like, we're not living in the world of 1966.
Right.
The world has changed very dramatically since then, and the policy ideas are not keeping up. And, you know, there's a tendency to want to think about history in terms of progress, that, like, we started down here, and then we continued to, you know, with ups and downs, we continued an overall upward trend toward an end point, right? That's not how history actually works, right? When you're experiencing it, it's happening in real time, and you don't know what the future is going to be. You don't know where things are going to go. You don't know if you're going to completely regress back to something else if you don't. And I think there's too much emphasis on, let's just defend the gains that we made in 1965, and not in terms of going past that. I think, you know, that's definitely evident on the racial front. A lot of people saying, like, well, we solved everything with the civil rights movement in 1965, and then we didn't have to do anything after that. I mean, clearly that was a mistaken approach. And there's all this emphasis still on, you know, the days of Martin Luther King Jr. And so with that, with Medicare, with any of these things, I think it's a mistake to think, okay, it's been like this for 50 years, therefore it's going to be like this forever and ever. And I'm not someone who says, oh, Social Security and Medicare are going to go bankrupt and there's no hope of saving them. I don't think that's the case. Although I think it's definitely possible that Republicans may use that to dismantle them, and that's why they wouldn't persist. But just, you know, if you think about it, things lasting for 50 years or 100 years, that's pretty impressive. It's also pretty unusual.
Right.
And if you're thinking of it in that terms, in those terms of history is one long progress movement, and you can go forward and you can never go back, and you think that we've reached that sort of like capstone, then you're going to have this mistaken impression that this will just be like this forever, and that this system that we have cannot be improved upon, and it will just be here forever and ever and ever. That is fundamentally unrealistic. I think, you know, there's going to be a lot of discussions too about this in the coming years, as we've started to see like the traditional party system breaking down in places like Europe. That I think you're seeing that starting to happen here to a lesser extent as well. You know, with people like Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, you know, starting to take off, especially the Donald Trump side and all the other, you know, clown car Republicans over there, right? They're unlike in Europe, they are participating in the normal parties rather than going off and forming their own parties for structural reasons. But, you know, a lot of people have said if somebody like Donald Trump were in Europe, he would have his own personal party and be controlling a significant share of seats in the national legislature or the European Parliament. And what we're seeing a lot of now is the stuff that was set into place in these major sort of reform periods, whether it's, you know, the Progressive Era, 1912 thereabouts, 1915, that was one set. The Great Depression, obviously, we got all that New Deal stuff in. Then there was the Great Society, things like that in the 1960s. And you see a lot of that is mirrored in their own versions of it in European countries at the same time periods. There's a lot of stuff that happened in the turn of the last century, or the, you know, World War One around then or just before. You know, the Great Depression era and the 1960s, there was a lot of changes that happened, and they've stuck with us for a long time. But I think it's really naive to think that they're just going to be like that forever. And I worry that we don't take on these big ideas because we're too stuck in that mindset that this is how it's always going to be. And it can't get better than that. And the Republicans, they are stuck on a slightly different time set, right? You got the Gilded Age, that's right before the Progressive Era. You've got the 1920s, the Roaring Twenties, that's also right before the Great Depression. And then you have, you know, to a lesser extent, some of the stuff in the 1950s, but even that was a little too socialist for them. So mainly the 1980s, where they tried to dismantle a lot of the stuff from the 60s. So they're all hung up on their own time periods, right? Mm-hmm. But no one's really coming up with these sort of, I mean, I don't want to call them revolutionary ideas and overstate the case, but no one's coming up with these paradigm shifting policy ideas that are going to respond to the fact that we now live in a 21st century globalized economy and everything is totally different, which is not to say that any, you know, these policies are bad or ineffective. The phrase I came up with for this is things that have reached their maximum effectiveness. Right. That they're not going to continue to be more effective and start to solve problems.
And I think this is my problem with President Obama's remarks about how the Affordable Care Act finished the job. I think it would have served him better and been much more truthful to say it made the healthcare system in America better. Now let's sit down and figure out what we can do to make it better next year. I mean, there are still plenty of problems with the system. We have to face the fact that we can't continue to spend such an outrageous part of our GDP on healthcare. So there are a lot of questions left to be answered, and Medicare and Medicaid are definitely part of that equation, and so is the Affordable Care Act. But without a vision going forward, I think we're dishonoring the legacy of Lyndon B. Johnson's Great Society, which really was him laying out what he would like to see for our country and then working with people on both sides of the aisles to make it happen.
Arsenal for Democracy will be back for one more segment before we wrap things up. So stick around with us from arsenalfordemocracy.com and WVUD. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Still in studio with me is Kelly. I want to talk now about a story that involves both the United States and Nigeria. Previously on Arsenal for Democracy, we've talked pretty extensively about the security situation in Nigeria with Boko Haram, as well as the Nigerian presidential election that happened. That was the first democratic, peaceful handover of power between parties that Nigeria has ever had. And so that was particularly impressive. But now the new president's been in there for a little bit of time and has made a trip to the United States. We're now getting to kind of see what direction he's taking things in. And so far, most people seem fairly positive about it, at least in the international community. But there was one particular thing that came up when he was visiting the United States that struck me as interesting. I don't know if I'm sure he's not the first person to come up with this suggestion, but it was an interesting one. So according to a Nigeria Pulse article that I wrote about on arsenalfordemocracy.com, President Muhammadu Buhari has appealed to the United States to help Nigeria by plugging all the loopholes that had been used by government officials to steal the country's assets rather than help with foreign aid. According to Malam Garba Shehu, senior special assistant to President Buhari, quote, "Buhari did not go to the U.S. with a begging bowl. We don't need foreign aid," he told everyone, "so long as the world powers can help us plug all the loopholes that had been used to steal our assets," end quote. So this was the Nigeria Pulse article reporting on this, and they talked about kind of some of the private and public donations or loans being made by, you know, people like folks like the Gates Foundation or the U.S. government to Nigeria. And certainly these have been important to Nigeria in the past. But one of the big problems for Nigeria, which is both the largest economy in Africa and also has the huge oil economy, one of the huge problems has been theft of resources. So whether it's embezzlement of revenue, you know, from the government revenue streams, or literal theft of public assets, sort of selling artificially lowered concessions for extraction of oil and gas, things like that, right? All of these things add up to various forms of theft that help ensure that people will remain poor in Nigeria and that a few people will become very rich from it. So some of this is your standard, you know, putting money into Cayman Islands bank accounts or Swiss bank accounts or whatever. Some of it has been, these multinational corporations bribing government officials to get these really cheap contracts, things like that. So it is true that this would be very helpful. I don't know if, you know, I don't know about the argument of saying, well, we don't need any foreign aid, just give us this assistance with closing these loopholes. But that is certainly a factor. Frank Vogel from Transparency International had written an article in 2013, I believe, in The Globalist, talking about hundreds of multinational firms involved in concession trading in Africa are registered in traditional tax havens such as the Cayman Islands, the British Virgin Islands, and Bermuda, or they're associated with shell companies registered in the United Kingdom or directed via financial entities in Switzerland and the United States. If the most powerful industrial countries take steps to curb tax evasion and the use of opaque holding companies by multinational resource extraction firms and by their African business partners, often in government positions, it would do much to benefit African citizens. Court actions in France and U.S. Senate investigations have brought to light vast luxury investments held in France and the U.S. in the names of some African leaders and members of their families. More importantly, Western governments could start to force banking institutions to implement existing Know Your Customer rules. These would compel African leaders to demonstrate how they obtained their fortunes and on what basis the cash is rightly their own. But my concern here about this idea of don't give us foreign loans, give us help on curbing embezzlement and things like that, is that I don't think this is going to be an effective appeal, because we also have these problems proportionally to a lesser extent, but still, you know, very significant impact, particularly not necessarily on the outright embezzlement of like tax resources and revenues, but, you know, companies not paying their fair share. We talk about that a lot. Companies not paying as much as they could for mining and things like that. Any of these sort of problems, tax avoidance, accounting games, financial network loopholes, all of these things are related to each other. They all need to be curbed by the G7 countries or the G20 countries. They periodically promise to do that and then they don't. So, you know, the UK has all these tax havens. I've talked about that previously a lot. Luxembourg has various tax havens. All these countries, they say they're going to do something about it and then they don't. And this hurts their own countries. And if it hurts their own countries and they won't do anything about it, I don't know that they're going to do it for Nigeria or any other developing nation. Kelly, what were your thoughts on this story?
I'd just like to say that it's very hard to silo all of these problems in developing countries, where what we need is education, or what we need is bank reform, or what we need is access to healthcare. The truth is, a place like Nigeria needs all of it. This was clearly a big ask to help close all these loopholes. I think it's an important ask. I think that when you are looking at communities or countries that are extremely or moderately resource rich, and there's no payoff for the country, you have to start looking at the system. Where is the money being drained? Is it going to the corporation? Is the government siphoning some off the top and stuffing their pockets? I saw it while I was working in Guatemala as a Peace Corps volunteer, that some of these mining communities had some of the worst standards of living. And you just have to wonder, they're living on top of gold. You know, where is this money going? So I think it is important that those committed to development and those committed to helping out Africa and Latin America and other developing countries really take a look at where this money is going, where it's ending up. And I think that closing these loopholes is an important step. I disagree that it's the only step.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of my take on it as well, is that, I mean, it's sort of, I think it's a public relations move to say, like, we don't want your handouts, we just want help fixing our own internal problems, essentially, that are, they're externally facilitated internal problems. I think that's, like, probably an appealing message to make. It also is, it's interesting because I think that it taps into some more conservative or pro-business type of people, where you say, like, again, you say, we don't want handouts. We just, like, this is the impact that your lack of regulation has on, like, you know, it's hurting our free market enterprise or whatever. I don't think that's going to necessarily work either, because I think that a lot of these people that are taking that position are too closely affiliated with these companies, mm-hmm. that are, again, as I said, either US or UK companies very often, and then are, you know, domiciled for tax purposes in various Caribbean islands. Or tax havens in Europe, onshore, offshore tax havens. But yeah, there is a huge cost associated with these schemes. And I think that, you know, that's something that unites the American people with the Nigerian people, right? You've got these huge opportunities. There's different ways that you can manage these sort of resources and deter various corruption and embezzlement. And we've come a long way in the United States relative to our own past history, but there's a lot more work to be done there as well. I mean, that's a big theme on today's show, is more work to be done on any of these things. But, like, that's something that if we fix those steps, you know, establish more transparency and establish various limits and prevent these sort of schemes for avoiding responsibility or outright stealing money, that doesn't just help Nigeria's people, that also helps us. That's how we have enough money to invest in infrastructure here in the United States, to invest in expanding various potential, you know, healthcare programs and things like that, to invest in our schools, any of these things that are big priorities that we've left for too long because we supposedly didn't have the money for it. We can close these loopholes if we want to, if we choose to. And it will not only help us, it will help people all over the world in developing nations to realize their own independent destinies as well. And then we don't, and then, you know, we don't have to end up giving them foreign aid later down the line because they have a route out on their own. So this is something that I think is vitally important to do. Although, as you said, at the moment, it needs to be an all of the above strategy of pursuing these things. However, I remain kind of pessimistic that this is actually going to happen. I don't think that this appeal is going to work, unfortunately, although it should. All right. Well, that is going to bring us to the end of our time today. But Kelly, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And that's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man, Justin. You can follow his work at the Digitized Ramblings of an 8-Bit Animal from 8BitAnimal.com. You can get additional commentary at ArsenalForDemocracy.com daily, as well as links to articles discussed today. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.